A recent scientific study set out to find out just how much bees are still exposed to the neonicotinoid pesticides that are so deadly to them. Neonics are blamed for some massive bee die-offs, including a couple of notable ones in Oregon. Those incidents led to cutbacks on the sale and use of the pesticides, but a study published in the journal Science skipped the bees and went straight to honey. In honey samples from around the world, 75% showed the presence of at least one of five neonicotinoids. We have two guests who know bees well to give us some reaction and perspective. John Jacob is the president of Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association, SOBA, and the owner of Old Soul Apiaries. John, good to have you back in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Dr. Dewey Caron's on the line with us as well. He is an entomologist, formerly of the University of Delaware at Oregon State. And he wrote pretty much the definitive book on beekeeping, Honey Bee Biology and Beekeeping. It's been through several editions. Dr. Caron, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Welcome.
Can we come to you first again and get something of an overview about the state of bees in the world right now as you see it?
Sure. We survey regularly both our small-scale backyard beekeepers and also from among our commercial beekeepers. The commercial beekeepers are doing pretty good. They're having losses in the area around 20%, which is a little bit higher than sustainable, but they can make up their losses by splitting and dividing existing survivors. The backyard story is not quite as rosy. They're not doing some things that need to be done with bees. Their timing is off just a little bit sometimes when doing some of those measures, and their losses will bounce up to 50%. It was 48% among my sample, which was roughly 300 beekeepers up and down the Willamette Valley and down in, along the coast, and then, of course, southern Oregon as well.
And the losses were how much again?
48% this past year for our backyard beekeepers. These are people with up to roughly 25 colonies.
All right. And John Jacob, give us a sense of what the state of bees is in Southern Oregon among the people you talk to all the time.
It definitely parallels what Dewey was stating. The commercial guys tend to do a little bit better than the backyard folks. there's definitely it's a challenging occupation for sure.
What is the biggest challenge in it then? What creates the biggest obstacles?
Well, we have a lot of challenges, you know, with pesticide issues. We also have some parasites that we wrestle with. We're dealing with habitat loss, climate change. I mean, it's a multifaceted industry-wide challenges.
So all sorts of things coming at you from different directions, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Have we gotten some, and let me turn this question actually to Susan Kegley, who joins us as well. She is with pesticideresearch.com. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Kegley.
Glad to be here.
So give us a sense of pesticide use. I mean, by now, it seemed like for five at least years, we've been talking about how many bee die-offs are caused by certain kinds of pesticides, neonicotinoids in particular, yet this seems to keep happening.
Well, the neonicotinoids are increasing in use over time, even still, as more and more crops are approved for treatment and more acres of land are treated with these chemicals, and they're persistent. They last for quite a number of years in the environment. So over time, the concentration and the loading of these chemicals into the environment is increasing. Corn is one of the biggest users of these neonicotinoid insecticides. And soybeans, and there's, you know, 95 million acres of corn and about 70 million acres of soybeans, depending on the year. So it's pretty extensive. In Oregon, I'm not sure what the major crops, potatoes that's used widely on potatoes, orchard crops, apples and pears.
How about on canola?
Canola, for sure. Yes, right. Absolutely. Right, absolutely. And these are often applied as seed treatments. And so the amount that gets into the plant itself is relatively small, but it does get into the pollen and nectar in concentrations that are, a few experiments have shown, may be affecting the bees. There's other experiments that show that you need more than that to affect the bees. But the one thing that's really clear is that the amount of pesticide that rubs off of the seeds and gets into the soil is actually quite a bit, and it runs off into the waterways where the bees and the aquatic invertebrates, you know, live. The bees drink the water, the aquatic invertebrates live there. So there's a pretty good loading of these pesticides into the environment, and it's increased over time.
This again, this starts with this report in the journal Science on October 6th called The Worldwide Survey of Neonicotinoids in Honey, and 75% of the samples, and it was a large number of samples, almost 200 from around the world, showed up at least one of the five neonicotinoids. And I want to hasten to add that these are below what are considered actionable levels for humans, but what do you read in the results, Dr. Kegley?
Well, as a chemist who has I've done these kind of analyses before, and our technology for detecting really trace levels of chemicals in the environment or in environmental samples has gotten really good. So we can see very, very tiny amounts of pesticides, and their detection limits were very low, so they were able to detect less than a part per billion of these pesticides. And I would say, so the average was 1.8 parts per billion in the overall samples of honey that they took. And so I went back and I looked at the what we get every day in our food, and the USDA analyzes produce for pesticides, and it turns out that you're getting much higher concentrations of pesticides in lettuce, cherries, apples, watermelon, squash, those kinds of peppers, tomatoes, and some 35% of cherry samples have detectable levels of, say, imidacloprid. I'm looking at the imidacloprid data now. Mm-hmm. 32% of lettuce samples have imidacloprid, and 14% of apples. So the honey seems like a very small piece of this puzzle. Mm-hmm. The bigger question is, how can we prevent contamination of both our food and the bees' food?
We're talking about bees and neonicotinoids, starting with that report in Science about honey and neonicotinoids. Susan Kegley is with PesticideResearch.com. Dr. Dewey Caron's an entomologist. John Jacob is the president of Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Dewey, what makes the bees so susceptible to the neonicotinoids? What is it in there? How does it work on them, I guess, is the question.
It is a mimic of nicotine, but made up chemically. It is a synthetic material. And so it is basically a poison that's affecting transmission of nerves. As it turns out, these are enhanced from nicotine that occurs naturally in some plants, such as, of course, tobacco. And what it does then is affects individual bee behavior. They lose short-term memory. They have a much shorter lifespan. They pass through their duties inside of their colony faster, come out to the field faster, and then just don't live as long, only a couple of weeks versus like a 5 to 6 week normal lifespan. So it's a behavior effector in a number of different ways, and it's an incredibly small amount that affects at least bee behavior. What we're having some difficulty trying to demonstrate is it does affect whole colonies. In other words, killing whole colonies. It's killing bees within a colony. And when they get something of that nature, pesticide, other pathogens that they have, their response is a social response to raise more bees. What we're really concerned is with this last demonstration of it being so pervasive in the product honey, is that although it was low for what we would consider as safety factors for human consumption, in other words, not a problem, it was found in levels in a good number of these samples at levels that we do know does affect individual honeybees.
So, John Jacob, then, what do you do with this knowledge as a beekeeper? I mean, when you know that it's out there as pervasive as Susan Kegley talked about, where so many crops are using neonicotinoids, and bees visit lots of different areas, I would assume. So, I mean, what do you do?
Well, industry practices have really had to change to adapt to the landscape that we're facing with. Beekeepers nowadays feed a lot more. I've seen a couple studies and know anecdotally that a lot of commercial guys are saying now that bees winter better on sugar syrup than honey. This could be part of the reason. And just to add to the background of how neonics affect bees, you know, a lot of these effects are described as sublethal. And even though it might not kill the colony outright immediately, their ability to deal with viruses and other diseases that the bees run into is much impaired. It's kind of like the straw that breaks the camel's back. Do you blame the last one, or you just take it as an aggregate and look at the the whole package of problems.
So it's one more thing that can take an already weakened colony and just create havoc.
Yes.
Let's take a call here. We have Ann in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Jacob, Dewey Karen, and Susan Kegley as we talk about bees.
Thank you. I plant plants in my small yard that the pollinators like. But what I've heard is that about one-third of our food crops are dependent on bees or other pollinators. And so just so that these chemical companies can make money, wouldn't the ultimate action of these different poisonous chemicals actually be the extinction of the human species? Thank you.
Thank you for that, Anne. That's a bit of a grim note there, but we'll take it. Can we take that on with you, Susan Kegley?
Thank you. So I don't think we're at risk of that yet. I don't even think we're at risk of honeybee extinction, because we do have some very good beekeepers out there that are managing their bees well. It is a serious issue. It is definitely a serious issue. And I think what's going to happen before any extinctions happen is that we're going to lose some of our food supply, some of the most interesting and nutritious part of our food supply, because we will have not a sufficient number of pollinators. The EPA is not moving quickly to regulate these pesticides, as you might imagine. And the number of uses has expanded over time, as opposed to taking a step back and rethinking which of these uses are, important to agriculture. Every farmer thinks their use is most important, but there are often other ways of managing pests besides using these persistent systemic chemicals that are very toxic to bees.
Are there alternatives that have been proposed? Are there viable alternatives in the minds of people who are in big agriculture?
There are the older pesticides. The reason that people turn to the neonics in the first place is that they're far less toxic to workers. And so the organophosphate insecticides, the carbamate insecticides, were highly toxic to workers, and worker poisonings were much more common than they are these days. So the neonics were hailed as great, increase in safety for workers, but they obviously didn't think about all of the other features. And it was out there in the environment before we realized what it was, the problems it was causing for the bees. So obviously, organic farmers do a very good job of growing crops with using very soft pesticides, oils and soaps to control soft-bodied insects, Bacillus thuringiensis, BT, to control caterpillars. So, there are other ways of managing pests. It's very difficult to manage your pests without using chemicals if you have a lot of the same kind of crop planted in the same place. This monoculture that we have now in agriculture makes it extraordinarily difficult to do pest management without chemicals.
Dewey, Karen, bees generally... Yes. Go ahead. Yeah, you had a point you want to bring in.
I'll only make the point that neonicotinoids are called systemics. That is, like, for example, on a corn seed of corn planted, there's still enough in the plant being translocated by the plant and persisting in the soil and the water in which the seed is planted, that when the plant goes to flowering, there's still enough that we can find that material in the flower. So that's what the bees are picking up in nectar or in pollen. The other choice, and your caller said that they go and buy plants around their yard, and we do need more diversity in planting for bees. But in many cases, those plants also have been treated by neonicotinoids before the consumer comes to get the plant.
Oh, so
corn
when you
growers
pick them up
don't really have a choice. They have to plant seed that has this neonicotine on it, because you hardly can't get corn that's not treated.
So there's all right. So if you wanted to make that kind of a crop, you'd have a hard time finding the seed that didn't have neonics in them.
Exactly.
Indeed, and so efficient. They're very effective, as Susan pointed out, and farmers are going to go with what works. Basically, we train them to do so, and they know, and they can tell the difference.
So John Jacob at the Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association, are there things that people who don't keep bees can do to help improve the environment for bees? Any plantings they can do in their own yard, stuff like that?
Well, like the previous caller mentioned, she was planting stuff already. That's huge. I mean, as much as pesticide residues are an issue for us, you know, habitat loss is a big issue. And you know, a lot of our conversation this morning centered around what big ag and big farms are doing, but it's also important to keep in mind that as an aggregate, we have more land under lawn cultivation than we do the big three commodity crops combined. So a lot of these materials are getting used by homeowners either inadvertently when they buy a plant that's already been treated, or just through direct sales, they go down to the local Grange and they buy a bottle of the stuff and start using it. So there's a lot that homeowners can do, as well as maybe addressing the way we farm things in big ag.
If you're spraying a lot of...
Things I could add, one of the things that people can do is grow things from seed. Because it's, for example, most flower seeds are not treated with insecticides. And they... it's relatively straightforward to grow many flowering plants like zinnias and cosmos, some things that the bees really, really love. Or you can direct seed certain things like phacelia, which bees are just wild over. And planting from seed makes it less likely that you're going to get some contaminated forage for your bees.
Well, John mentioned all the space that we have in yards and lawns. I mean, if we're out there just trying to make sure that we're keeping things nice and neat with the Roundup, is that potentially a problem for bees too, Susan?
So here's the interesting thing. We know that neonics are toxic to bees because they're an insecticide. They're meant to be toxic to insects. And so many, many studies have been done on the neonics. Glyphosate is an herbicide. It's not acutely toxic to bees, meaning it doesn't kill them right away. We have very little knowledge about what the sublethal effects, the ones that don't kill them right away, but we don't know much about the effects of glyphosate that aren't acute, because there's no studies that have been done. So I would have to say the jury's out on that one.
Wow, but really interesting.
Kill them right away.
John Jacob, just a couple seconds here. Are more people getting involved in beekeeping? Are they contacting you all the time?
Oh, yes. There's been a huge boom for about 6 or 7 years now in backyard beekeeping. It's really, really, really popular at this time.
All right. John Jacob is the president of Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association. Dewey Cairns, an entomologist formerly of Delaware and Oregon State. Susan Kegley at PesticideResearch.com. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.